stories of missing time, cattle mutilation.
Yep.
There were things that you find in headlines today. But there were also some very unique stories that were different than anything that you're probably ever going to read anyplace else, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen,
it was just amazing, the story, you know, of, I mean, you know, how he talked about following those little footsteps. And when they get up to the top of the mountain, how there's a clearing there. And in that clearing was that round circle where there was no snow. These were stories that they remembered, stories of events that happened. The alien becomes quite interested in the fact that this dog obeys his commands, and so he demonstrates some things for him, kind of showing off. And when they get to the crash, the alien wants the dog. I feel privileged to have been told the stories, to have them, you know, given to me, and I just hope that it in some way does help unravel the mystery that we've been dealing with for over a century now, or even longer than that.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 7, coming at you a little later than I would like, but we have an awesome episode on tap for you folks. On this edition of the program, we are joined by author Artie Sixkiller Clark, who is going to share her revelatory and unique research into American Indian experiences with UFOs and ETs, as chronicled in her new book from Anomalous Books, Encounters with Star People. And you are going to hear me rave about this book when the conversation starts, because I absolutely loved it. I cannot recommend it enough to the BOA audio listeners. What makes this a special book is that these are stories that were confided to Artie from Native Americans that really, prior to the publication of the book, only maybe two or three people had ever heard. And they are breathtaking. I'm going to give you a little teaser of them in a moment, but really, folks, they are fascinating and fresh. As I said, only a handful of people have ever heard these stories up until Artie put the book out, and I'm sure a myriad of listeners right now are hearing these tales for the very first time. Over the course of the conversation, you are going to hear stories that include an alien being rescued from a blizzard, a man who claims aliens use his reservation land to drop off ETs to integrate into society, a pair of women who contend that they were stranded aliens on Earth, as well as how one man thwarted an ET from stealing his dog. We'll also really dig into the process and find out how Artie ended up becoming the confidant to these Native Americans who decided to share their stories with her, and we'll look at some of the trends and outliers that emerged from the many stories she's been told over the years. And there's also some really interesting insights we're going to learn about the culture of American Indians, including their preferred nomenclature, Native American reservations, the boarding school era of Indian education, and other fascinating insights into the original inhabitants of North America. So, a whole slew of additional material that I didn't even know we were going to get into before the conversation started, and stuff that I really enjoyed learning about. Altogether, it is a truly breathtaking edition of the program, which offers a wealth of previously untold tales of UFO and ET encounters by witnesses who have a unique respect for the phenomenon, with our guest, Artie Sixkiller Clark. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Artie Sixkiller Clark, please allow me to provide you with a little background on her. Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark, a professor emeritus at Montana State University, has dedicated her life and career to working with indigenous populations. She has been adopted and given traditional names by 3 Northern Plains tribes, including the Blackfeet, the Northern Cheyenne, and the Lakota Sioux. The author of several children's books and the best-selling Sisters in the Blood, she continues to work as a consultant to American Indian tribes and indigenous communities worldwide, and is currently working on a second volume of work about the indigenous people of Mexico and the Star People. Her website is www.sixkiller.com, pretty simple, all one word, sixkiller.com. Check it out. And with all that said, my friends, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on February 4th, 2012. Artie, Sixkiller Clark, talking about encounters with Star People on BOA Audio Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Very excited about this installment of the program. Our guest is Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark, and she is the author of the fantastic book, Encounters with Star People, Untold Stories of American Indians. Folks, this book is tremendous. I just read it this past week and could not put it down. And this is coming from someone who's been looking at the UFO phenomenon for years and years and years. And often you've heard me on the program, folks, talk about how I get tired of hearing the same old stories over and over and over again. Well, this book was like a breath of fresh air. It contains so many really amazing stories from American Indians regarding a whole myriad of strange encounters with ETs, or Star People as they're known, and UFOs. So just some tremendous stuff, and really just what I needed as I sort of get more and more cynical about the UFO phenomenon. This book really kind of gave me a breath of fresh air. So I cannot wait to talk about it with Artie. So welcome to the program, Artie. This is going to be a lot of fun, I think.
Well, I hope so.
I think that's what every guest thinks when they start, yeah.
Right. I'm sure.
I think we're going to have some fun. Let's, you know, we usually start out here with the standard bio background. You know, who is Artie Sixkiller Clark? And, you know, how did you end up putting together Encounters with Star People?
Well, my profession, I've been a teacher, a school administrator, and a college professor for many, many years. And when I first came to Montana State University, I was out. One of the things I did was go out and recruit Native students to come to MSU to study to be teachers and principals and superintendents. And I wrote grants to get scholarship money to fund their education. And I was out on one of the reservations, and a colleague who hosted me out there that evening said to me, if you got time, you know, I want you to take a ride with me. And so we went up in the hills above his little village, and he proceeded to say, well, now, well, if we're lucky, they'll come. And I said, well, who will come? And he said, well, the ancestors, the Star People. And as I sat there and I listened to him, and we didn't see anything that night, unfortunately, but I began wondering how many tribes out there had similar stories, and if people would be willing to tell me the stories. So I went back to the university, and I was talking with one of the professors there, and he said, well, you know, there are a lot of tribes that have star stories. Old legends about interaction with star people or events that went on in the heavens. And so I began researching that. And when I would go out on my trips to recruit students or go out to do my research, because later I got a lot of grants to do research with children and women, and I started asking questions. And was there anyone out there that had experiences with UFOs? And it would come at maybe a dinner or, you know, and people started coming forth and telling me their stories. And at first, I really had no intention of writing the book. It was just for my own curiosity. I was interested in this whole phenomena. And actually, when I had put everything away and locked it away, and I was I had retired from the university, and I was about a year after I retired, maybe a couple, I got a call from some people in South Dakota asking me if I would be willing to come out of retirement and do a 5-year project with them and evaluate and conduct research on a project that they had been funded by the federal government. And so I went to Washington, I went to a training institute, I went through the whole process, and then I made my preliminary trip to the reservation. And I still wasn't quite sure if I wanted to commit for 5 years. And so that afternoon we're sitting around and there's a group of us women, we're having lunch together, and someone mentioned something about a UFO, and I began telling them a few of the stories that I had collected over the years. And one of the ladies said to me, she said, "What are you going to do with all these stories?" And I said, "Well, probably nothing." And she said, "Well, I really think this is a part of our oral narratives. This has to be written down. You need to write a book about this. Because once you pass, nobody is ever going to know about this."
Yeah.
And so I, all the way home, I'm thinking, do I want to write a book or do I want to take this job? And I thought, well, you know, I spent a lot of years out there doing that same thing, doing research and evaluation. And did I want to get back into that, or did I want to try my hand at writing a book? And so the book went out, obviously.
Well, yeah, we
and
know the end.
That's what I did. I wrote the book.
We know the decision you made. Yeah.
Right.
Well, it was
so that's how it all came to be.
Awesome, awesome. Well, it was a great decision. I commend you for it. Like I said earlier in the introduction, you hear so many stories, but this is like, there's something really special about these stories, not just because they're so frank, which I thought was really interesting, is the frankness of the way these witnesses tell these stories. They're not like the typical witnesses. And also, I thought it was really commendable, I guess you could say, that most of these stories, I think you were like maybe the second or the third person to know about it, and up until you published the book, probably only the second or third person to have heard the story.
That's true.
I mean, these are incredibly rare encounters.
And that, both of what you're saying is true. You know, they hadn't discussed it. Actually, I think some of them had told their families. A couple of them had told friends.
Right.
But for most part, they just kept it quiet. You know, it was more like, well, it happened, and that's the way it happened, and there's no need to dwell on it or talk about it. And one of the things that in many of the Native communities, they wanted to protect their reservation. They didn't want some travesty made out of the whole thing or a spectacle, you know, to happen. And so they were very cautious about, you know, not getting the word out there so that people would start. They didn't want a lot of people coming around and asking questions, you know.
Especially UFO fans.
Right. And that's what they were concerned about.
Yeah. And I don't blame them for that. Yeah, so like I said, just tremendous stuff. And you know, as the person who encouraged you to write the book, you know, made the point. If not for you, these stories almost certainly never would have got out there. So
because the people who told me, you know, told them to me with the understanding that I wouldn't reveal who they were. But at the same time, you know, I tried to establish an atmosphere where they were just talking to a friend.
Right.
And I know that, you know, some people will say, well, then nobody else can follow up on it. Nobody knows whether it's true or not. Well, the fact of the matter is, it's true. And I promised the people that nobody would be able to follow up on them. You know, they just did not want that. And if they ever come out and say, well, I'm the person in the book and I'm the one who told the story, that's up to them. It won't come from me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I'm already finding this conversation fascinating. I'm going to be tongue-tied, I think, as I go along, as we talk more. But there's a couple of sort of notes in the beginning of the book that I wanted to touch on. In the beginning, you have this author's note, and I think it's important that we talk about this, because I never heard this sort of new development in the nomenclature of American Indians. But you say in the book that now it's accepted that to call them American Indians rather than Native Americans?
Right. Because one of the things there are a lot of Native researchers today and Native writers, and one of the things, as I mentioned in there, Tim Gallego, who was one of the first and greatest American Indian journalists, said that all of his life, you know, he started being confronted with this issue. How can you call yourself Native American? I'm Native American, too, because I was born here, and that makes me Native American. So basically what we decided to do is to use American Indian, which distinguishes us from those who are Native born to this land. Because you're right, you know, you're Native American, and anybody who's born here is Native to America. So we decided professionally to use American Indian. And, of course, tribes always prefer to be called by their own name, which is, you know, Lakota instead of Sioux or rather than the name that was given to them by, you know, the Euro-American Society. But yeah, we use American Indian. You're going to find that more and more and more.
Yeah, that's fascinating in a way, because it was...
And I quote Tim Gallego there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
About that, you know, because he spoke about that very issue.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you certainly explain it very well. Like I said, I'd never even... Growing up, I'd always been told that you weren't supposed to call Native Americans Indians. So now it's changed completely. It's turned back around the other way. So it's interesting.
And you can understand why.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's what took me by surprise, that now they've embraced it. So.
Right.
And then let's talk a little bit about the preface, because that's where you really sort of explain how this all came together. I thought it was interesting, you know, you sort of alluded to this here earlier. You say in the preface that there's these two kinds of research, I may mispronounce these, but the etic research and the emic research.
Right, etic and emic.
Yeah, there you go, see? Thank you. So I guess talk about that and how your style is really different, because I thought it was, like you said, I mean, these stories are really being told on a personal level. It's not like you're corralling folks and sort of cajoling them into telling the story. More often than not, they just sort of come up, you know, in happenstance.
In a conversation,
right.
Yeah. If you look, anthropologists talk about etic and emic research. Etic comes from the perspective of an outsider, somebody who is outside the culture looking in. And so it's very easy to, as an outsider who is unfamiliar with the culture, to misinterpret. You observe something and you misinterpret it because you don't understand how it works within the culture. An emic perspective is coming from someone inside the culture, someone who has lived, say in this case, among Native people who know how they, know how they respond to situations and know something about the traditions. Now, I'm not saying I knew something about all the culture of all the people I interviewed, but I knew how to approach people. I knew what was acceptable. I knew how you treated elders, and so that made for a different situation. I talk about how, often you find researchers who will go out and pay somebody $2 and a half or $3 or $10 to fill out a form, a questionnaire.
Right.
And they think nothing of that. But in my case, I'll go with food or different kinds of things, tobacco, and present to people. There's no difference. But sometimes people don't understand that when they look at what I do, because they say, well, you know, you're bribing them. Well, it's no different than giving them a $10 bill or a $5 bill to fill out a questionnaire. And so it's just understanding enough about the culture to go in and to be able to put people at ease and for me to feel at ease.
Exactly.
And then the other thing, recognizing how star legends were so much a part of a lot of the cultures I was visiting, being able to be accepting of what they told me without questioning it or criticizing or evaluating it or putting my opinion. That's something I really worked at not trying to do, to not influence them.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. You're sort of just like recording these stories, which is great.
Right.
Questions where it's pertinent to flesh out the details, but not sort of trying to poke holes in the story.
Right. And then accepting what they said, you know, as, you know, that I in no way discounted what they had to tell me.
Hmm.
And I think that was an important part of getting the information.
Well, like I said, when we started here, I thought it was interesting just to kind of get the sense in reading their stories that they were really very matter-of-fact about it. You kind of made mention mm-hmm. of this, you know. They were like, well, this is what happened. It didn't seem like the people telling you the stories were trying to sensationalize it or you know, add color for dramatic effect. It was like they were just telling you what happened in plain language, and,
mm-hmm.
and even though these were amazing stories.
Well, and one of them, and this might come as a surprise, but, you know, I collected close to 1,000 stories.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
And it was really difficult to choose the ones that I was going to tell, because I could have written a dozen books about the stories that I was told. I tried to choose a variety of stories, ones that would demonstrate the uniqueness of the stories I was told, and at the same time present an overall view of the phenomena. You know, there were stories of missing time. There were, you know, the same cattle mutilation.
Yep.
There were things that you find in headlines today. But there were also some very unique stories that were different than anything that you're probably ever going to read anyplace else, you know.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
And that's the thing that I tried it's just the way I think American Indians look at it in a different perspective, that it's all a part of the worldview, the cosmos, and a part of the universe.
Exactly. It's not just that they were matter of fact about the story, but they were matter of fact almost about the facts of the story. It was like,
right.
You know.
That it's not anything uncommon that if you're, you know, that it's just part of the universe.
Exactly. It was, like I said earlier, it was refreshing. It was really refreshing to hear these stories, especially when we see so much garbage in the paranormal community, in the UFO field. It's like, this was such a nice book.
So one of the things that interested me so much as they were telling the stories is they weren't hypnotized, they weren't,
right. It's important to stress that. Yeah.
They were none of those kinds of things. These were stories that they remembered, stories of events that happened. And they were quite unusual. And you know, the story of the man who told the story about, he said, everybody says, you know, talks about little green men, but my aliens had red eyes. And he made that bracelet with the alien with the red eyes and gave that to me, you know. And just those unique things that happened, you know, during this whole process that I don't think other interviewers have ever encountered.
Oh, certainly not. Certainly not. Now, I'm sure people are going to want to hear some stories, so we'll sort of ease them into some of these as we go along. And let's start with one. I had it here later in the notes, but it sort of sets up a point I want to make later. So tell me about the story of the Alaskan blizzard. Did that
right.
ring a bell for you? It's
oh,
a pretty
yeah.
It's a pretty memorable story.
The young man as if he were sitting across from me today. I mean, he came in and walked in. I'm sitting in a restaurant, and he came in to tell me that somebody told him I was collecting stories about UFO encounters, and so he came to talk to me. And I think when he came to see me, I mean, he was, I think it was to get it off his chest. He hadn't told other people. He had been pretty quiet about it. But I think, you know, he just needed somebody to talk to, somebody to say, well, you know, you're not the only one.
Right.
You're not the only one that these things have happened to. And I was able to do that for him because his story was one of the most unusual, obviously, that I heard. You know, he ran that snowplow, and a terrible blizzard comes up. And, in fact, I happened to be in that vicinity that night that blizzard came. And he tells about how he comes upon this spacecraft sitting in the middle of the road, and he stops his snowplow, and this alien is actually outside the craft, and the craft leaves without him, and he invites him to stay with him out of the cold because the alien tells him he's freezing.
Yeah.
And the alien has the ability to appear and disappear, apparently at will. And when I asked him, I said, well, what did the two of you talk about? He said, I was so scared, I didn't even think of anything to say. And apparently, they didn't do a lot of talking, although the alien did talk to him a little bit about some kind of magnetism used in propulsion. He took him back to the same spot, and the craft came back and got him. And a couple of days later, the military showed up in the town where he was working, asking questions if anybody had seen a UFO. And he just kept his mouth shut. He figured that he didn't need to tell anybody anything.
Yeah.
But what an interesting story.
I was left agog at that one. I was just like, oh, my God, this is remarkable.
It was a remarkable story, and he told it with such sincerity that I believe it happened to him.
Right, right. And like you pointed out, this was recent, relatively speaking.
Oh, yeah. This is very recent.
Yeah. So we're not just talking about old legends and stuff like that.
Oh, no. This is something that happened to him while he was on the job in the middle of a blizzard. And he's, you know, he admitted that it was a little bit disconcerting, but when he came to me, one of the things that he said, you know, he talked to me about was, were there other people out there that similar things had happened to? You know, I mean, he was wanting that kind of assurance, and of course there were. I mean, not in the same way as had happened to him, but certainly other people had encounters, and that seemed to, you know, make him feel good that he was able to,
right?
You know, that it wasn't something out of the that nobody else had ever experienced.
Well, one of the things that piggybacks onto that story is in a couple of the stories that you're told. The aliens or the star people, I guess we can kind of use those, you know, interchangeably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. They exhibit almost like human-like qualities in some sense, as seen in that story. And in another one, this guy talks to an alien, and the alien says he couldn't resist talking to a human, and he'll probably get in trouble for it, which I thought was interesting, because you think that there are these cold and calculating type creatures, but then they exhibit these kind of, you know, feelings. And in the Blizzard story, the alien says, we saw you coming, we got frightened, we left, and
right.
They left me behind. It's a young crew, they're probably going to get in trouble for this.
Right.
So it's like almost
happened a couple of times that people, in those stories that somebody said, you know, that they were concerned that they were going to, you know, have some problems with their superiors because of what their encounter with humans, because they're not. One of the things that I heard over and over again was that whole concept of universal non-interference.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't heard before, but that there is this, I don't know if you call it a law or what you call it, but an understanding of not that there non-interference that when you visit, you observe, you collect data, but you do not interfere. And when I questioned the one elder who said that he apparently had a lot of encounters, he said, well, they're different races, just as there are here. Different people, not people, but different
entities or whatnot.
Entities that, and they don't always abide by the law, just like we don't always abide by the law.
Exactly, yeah.
And so that would account for perhaps abductions or impregnating, you know, females, you know, that kind of thing. But as a rule, the group had agreed on non-interfering with the people of planet Earth. And So they had that concern. But then you remember in the case of the Navajo elder who helps the alien or Starman back to his craft because he was lost.
Yes.
And he takes his young grandson with him. Do you remember that story?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, now, see, they came out to greet him. So there was that, too. So there, that's two people saying that were not, that they encountered aliens who were concerned about interacting with them, even though they wanted to, and another one saying that they came out and greeted his grandfather, you know, and then later indicated he came back and visited him again when the grandfather was dying, remember?
Yeah, so it makes you wonder what kind of rules they're beholden to.
See, right, or if you know, these groups are so distinctly different that, you know, that they abide by their own rules.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But apparently, you know, I know the one elder told me that this is something that they felt that was really important, is that whole idea of non-interference.
Well, there's certainly, yeah, that's been sort of speculated upon in ufology for years and years and years, just because of why they keep coming here and not doing anything. So it stands to reason something's holding them back from letting us know that they're around. I did think, just to even go a little bit deeper into that, I'm remembering now the story about the guy in the blizzard. When the alien gets picked up, he kind of turns around and gives him a little salute. Like thank you for
yeah,
saving my life,
yeah.
Which I thought was pretty
almost like a human-like character.
Right. That's right. What I really liked about those stories too. It's you very rarely hear the facade come down from their side. Where I don't think I've ever heard a story where the ET is like, "Listen, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I had to do it." Like I don't
well,
think I've ever heard a story.
What about the one where the little boy gives him a marble?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and he takes this marble, and then these two children, this brother and sister, just sit out at night and fantasize about where their marble might be, and they tell me this story when they're adults, and they tell it to me, the sister tells me about it before I even meet the brother, and they have the same story to tell. But I found that to be just a fascinating story. And the sister to this day hasn't forgiven him for taking that marble down there, because she said if she'd known he had taken a marble, she would have taken something too. You know, she would have had something out there. But, you know, there were a number of situations where the star people were made to appear as have human-like qualities.
Hmm.
But in other cases, you know, you didn't find that. You know,
right.
You remember the story of Willie Joe. Willie Joe was taken, and he didn't want to go, and he'd been taken from the time he was a little boy. And he's telling the story of being cloned, that they had created another entity that looked exactly like him. And every year they came and they took him.
Right. There are certainly oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And he was very angry about it. You know, I mean, he was very fearful that the same thing would happen to his nieces and nephews. I mean, he said he had never married because he didn't want children to go through that. His children to go through that. And so he was very protective of his nieces and nephews. Not that he could have done anything about it, it didn't sound like, because he couldn't protect himself.
Well, there's certainly, you know, like we're talking about sort of the human aspects of these entities, but there are, as you said, there's some troubling stories in there, too. I mean, there's one with the guy who says the aliens come and drop off carloads of human-looking aliens that just drive off of his property into God knows where. I think he said, you know, probably to bus stations or airports and to spread out it into the population, which is...
And that was one of the most chilling stories I heard.
Yeah.
And Leland was such a wonderful gentleman. And I have no doubt that this happened. And of course then, you know, the last time I saw him, his friend was staying there. This old cowboy, that had been his friend for, you know, 60, 70 years came and was staying with him because Leland wasn't doing too well. And I had gone there and he had verified that, you know, that he had, while he was staying there, that he had seen the same thing, the craft coming. it lowering this automobile with these entities in it, and then they're leaving, driving away. And the first time he told me the story, he took me out to show me the tire tracks.
Yeah.
And he said, this is where they come. And this is how they drive out of my property. And so I have no doubt that he was telling the truth. Absolutely none.
Right. And just to flesh it out even more, I guess, talk a little bit about, he changed a tire for one of these cars.
This
isn't just witnessing a car coming out of a UFO. He actually dealt with one of these cars.
Well, and he said that the one of the tires went flat. And he said the entity came to his door, but never knocked, just stood out there, like he didn't know what to do. And finally, he opened the door. And the comment that interested me too is he said that, you know, that it was like he had no neck. He never really got a good look at him, you recall. And he said, but the one thing I noticed, he seemed to have no neck because he had this collar pulled up and this hat on. And so he goes out there and there's a flat tire. And he changes the flat tire. And he makes them get out of the vehicle because he's got to jack it up. And he said they get out on the other side and they stand in this huddle, you know, away from him, as though they're fearful of him, almost, and he changes the tire, and then he's given 10 silver dollars, and I got the last one that he had, you know, he after he died, his friend gave it to me.
Yeah.
I found that interesting. You know, if you're going to do business, and you're an alien, perhaps you think that silver coins are you know, okay to use, you know,
right.
Because that's what they gave him.
Yeah.
But he said he never got a chance to get any more. He sure wished he could get some more because he took it someplace over in Nebraska and they gave him, you know, like $15 or $20 for it. So he thought he was rich. He wished he could get some more of those silver dollars. But I found that not only a chilling story, but a really interesting story about how he described the creature that came to his door, how he, the fearfulness of the passengers inside, and then his whole idea that they were taken. I said, well, where do you think these people are going? Because he said the guy would come back, or the driver would come back, not the guy, but the driver would come back, and there wouldn't be any passengers. And he said, well, he thought they were, he said if they left them here on the reservation, everybody'd know it, you know, because
right.
Everybody knows everybody. So he said they must be taking them, you know, like to a airport or to a bus terminal someplace, and just, then they're just mixing in with the population and nobody really knows.
God only knows why. That's the scary. You wonder why they are doing this, but hopefully it's people.
But it's certainly interesting, and it is chilling, you know, when he told me this story, I thought, my goodness, you know, maybe the one next door to you, you don't know, you know.
I've had some strange neighbors. That may be false.
Maybe.
Another sort of theme or trend or sort of through line that I noticed over the course of these stories is a lot of the witnesses, they say they talked to the entities, and I thought it was interesting, and maybe you can extrapolate on this or give me your thoughts on it, but I thought it was interesting that throughout all the stories, and I think in a couple of points you even actually sort of stop and ask them to clarify, no one ever exactly says like that they were literally talking, but they don't even say, they never really kind of get around to explaining how they communicated with these entities. It's presumed to be telepathy, you know, I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think it was telepathy. You know, because like you said, I did ask some of them, well, was he speaking? How did he sound? And they said, well, you know, all of a sudden they said, well, we don't know.
Right. It speaks
you know,
to the
because,
perspective of the witness
you know,
in a way.
And then they just had to stop and think, how did they communicate with us? You know, they just knew what the entity, you know, the conversation that was going back and forth. They just seemed to know. They said that.
Right,
know.
Right. Well, that's what I found interesting because you know you hear these other UFO stories from, you know, maybe non American Indians, And they always seem to get a little tripped up or stress the telepathy part of it. It always seems to come up like, you know, oh, but they were communicating via the mind. But in these stories, it was, again, matter of fact. It was, yeah, we were talking. Well, how are you talking? Well, I didn't really even think too much about it. He was just talking to me. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, and I think that part of that comes, from, at least in part, from some of the cultures, because some of us,
right.
You know, I mean, in spiritual ceremonies and different types of traditional ceremonies, you know, feel that we receive messages and that, you know, we get information, and I think if you read accounts of different spiritual men, you'll see that as well, you know, so that communication, it doesn't always have to be communication, verbal communication. It can be messages that you receive otherwise. But that's the difference, I think, between, again, Eddie and Emic research, because I accepted that without really questioning it. And then when there are just a couple of times I finally just said, well, where are you talking? Because I found that interesting myself. Because sometimes I felt when I was talking to them that even though there wasn't an oral conversation going on, that they felt comfortable in I think just using their minds, you know, in their communication, which is natural.
Yeah. Interesting. Another sort of thing that stood out to me in these stories, we kind of gone over the idea that there's all these different races possibly coming here, and that you talk about chilling. Another aspect of it was in one of the stories, a few of the stories, but in one in particular, the witness says these star travelers are different from the original star people.
Mm-hmm.
So to dispel this misconception that, I mean, some cultures do believe that there were these star people that predated and were amongst the American Indians, but
right.
Sometimes in these cases they're also saying that there's these other races that are now coming here that are not
right.
from the original star people
right.
line, if you will.
And I sure found that in Mexico because, you know, I spent 4 years traveling to Mexico among the Maya. And along the way, I had gone there originally when I planned my trip to Mexico I had not intended to collect UFO stories. But when I left for Mexico, it was kind of following a teenage dream of following in the footsteps of these explorers, these two explorers named Gatherwood and Stevens, who had made this trek through Central America and Mexico, looking for these ancient cities that they had heard rumors about back in they started out in 1839. I was so fascinated by what they did that I decided when I was a teenager I was going to do this one day. I was going to follow in their footsteps. Well, back in 2006, you read all the things that Eric von Däniken has written and all these different people about ancient astronauts and how, you know, Pakal in Palenque was an astronaut and all these what to me were very outrageous things. Just another example of saying, well, here are these indigenous people who couldn't possibly be smart enough to build these cities. And so I set out not only to follow in Stevens and Catherwood's footsteps, but I also wanted to find out along the way, if there was anybody who would talk to me about UFOs. And of course, I found, much more colorful stories, much more, among the Maya. I mean, they believe they came from Pleiades.
Yeah.
And so that's a part of their belief system. This is where we came from. This is who we are. And so they don't make any excuses for that. And I ran on to a professor down there who literally told me, he said, you know, I believe what happened is that that many of the people who came here were scientists and engineers, and they helped us build these great cities. And when their job was done, they went back to where they came from, and we stayed behind. And this is who we are now, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And of course that was his idea, but then he used a lot of examples to show me why he felt that way, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting to me to find that commonality, you know, that you start talking to indigenous people. And I found that in Australia, too, when I was in Australia. A really strong connection with the star people and with the stars.
Why do you think that there's been this disconnect between the natives of all these places and, you know, it's...
Well, I think when you start looking at what happened to the indigenous people of this world,
yeah,
look at what happened in America, look what happened in Mexico. I mean, the cultures were devastated. The people, you know, I mean, they were in survival mode. And the same thing in Australia, you know, look at what's happened. I mean, the disconnect where the children were taken away and put in boarding schools in the Americas and in Canada, in Australia, and where the traditional stories and all the things that they knew, so much of it was lost.
Yeah.
You know, you take the Maya, you know, all of their books, everything they had written, you know, only four of their books, they're called the Codexes, have survived the burning and purging by the Spanish who landed on those shores, you know. So all of that was lost, and perhaps the people just found it easier not to think about it, talk about it, you know, just survival.
Right, right. Yeah, it seems that way, and such a, in a way, it feels like the knowledge and the information about the star people is such a precious knowledge in a way. Maybe it's like they feel like we don't deserve to know about the true, what really is going on or what really happened.
Well, I think there's some of that, but I also think that you've got a centuries of people discounting what the stories.
Hmm.
You know, back when I was about, I don't know, a couple of decades ago, maybe. No, it wasn't that long ago, maybe 15 years ago. I was sitting in my office at the university, and the dean sent for me. And I went up to his office, and there were a group of people there from NASA.
Hmm.
And they wanted to talk to me about the star legends of Native American tribes in Montana.
Oh, wow.
And here's NASA all of a sudden interested in star stories. And I was just kind of blown away by that whole idea, you know. And so I sent them up to the Blackfeet Indian Reservation, where there's some just really rich stories there, and told them maybe you need to talk to the people out in the field and talk to the people on the reservations. And when they first went up there, they talked about opening up some kind of a center that would be an information gathering center for all the star knowledge of the native people. Well, that never happened. NASA's budget was cut and all these kinds of things. But if you go on NASA's site, there is a section on there about Native American star lore. And I find that really interesting, because these are stories that people said, oh, those are just legends. They don't mean anything.
Right.
There's no truth in that.
Is that what NASA says on the, or do they?
Oh, no,
give it?
No more. Yeah, you know, right. And that's what I find interesting, is how we've almost come this full circle, you know, where the knowledge that we had was so disrespected and disregarded as just fiction. And now you've got people coming back and saying, well, what about those stories? You know, because, well, I always believe every culture I've ever been in, you know, if the story is told, there's some truth behind it.
Right, right. Exactly.
And we need to just start listening, you know, to what people have to say.
That's absolutely, that cuts across the board beyond Native Americans and the paranormal, but absolutely. It's all very fascinating Speaking to that sort of idea, what you're talking about, I do always find it interesting, and one of the stories in the book does sort of mention this idea, so I'm not just plucking this out of thin air. One of the people, I think, I remember now, was the guy who had the petrified heart, and you
right.
can talk about that a little bit if you want, and he said that he had been told by his grandfather or through the lineage that the star people lived on the continent with the Native Americans, or the, let me see here, I keep saying Native Americans, I hope that's okay, with the...
That's all right.
Okay, with the American Indians. warned them that the white people were coming, left, took some of the American Indians with them, and sort of were sort of like, listen, you either come with us or it's going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that stayed obviously went through a horrific time, and they sort of were left to their own devices because they didn't go along with the Star people and leave. So I find it interesting that, you know, through all of human history, as far as beyond the recorded history from the American Indians, I'm talking about sort of the, unfortunately, the accepted mainstream history, so much of the history of the North American continent really is lost. I mean, they very well could have been Star people living amongst the Native Americans, you know, in the California area, in some of these parts of, you know, maybe 500 or 600 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
While all of this, you know, European history was going on and all this stuff was happening in Europe and in the Middle East and places where we have the recorded history. So it's remarkable. There could have been two different worlds operating on the planet that didn't actually come together until the white people came to America and sort of codified a unified world history, if you will.
Well, you know, and one of the things I find fascinating is that they're finding all of these giant races. You know, they just read the other day where they had uncovered a whole group of giant skeletons of people that were buried together. Well, you know, I can't remember which tribe it was, but as I was doing some research, came across this article that was in an old newspaper about this story that had been told to this journalist by this elderly Indian, and he had said that at one time his people had been preyed upon by these red-headed giants that lived in these caves near where his people lived. And that finally, they killed them all. The tribe, you know, the warriors killed all of them, just killed them all off. And I keep thinking about those things, you know, the different stories of the different tribes. One of the tribes tells the story of these giants that were cannibals that lived along the great river that they had to cross and coming out of, the implication is they came out of Mexico and crossed this great river, and they had to be very careful because they had to get this by this group of cannibalistic giants. So I found all kinds of giant stories among the Maya down in Mexico, you know,
yeah,
telling me different things. So you start putting all this together, you know, and you say, you know, I think, you know, there is truth in these stories. They're just not legends. They're just not myths. They are the truth of what was experienced, and people just didn't listen.
So,
or it wasn't passed on the way it was, you know. Because, you know, oral history has never been as valued as written history. Let's face it, you know.
Yeah.
Oral history has always been looked upon as folklore, more or less. So it brings a whole different perspective. The other thing, I think, the other element that's playing into this is if you accept that there was a history of America before the white man ever came here,
right,
then that means that the indigenous people who lived here have some kind of knowledge that you don't have.
Exactly.
And that's difficult for you know, historians to accept or to write about. Let's face it.
I mean,
that's true. Because that means this group of people actually had a history and different things were happening, you know, than what was the norm in Europe, you know, when the people came here.
Exactly. And it's not, we're not just talking about, like, decades. We're talking about hundreds of years, if not thousands.
And you know, if you go down into Mexico and Central America and you visit the Maya Indian and you visit those ancient cities down there, I mean, these people were building magnificent cities with 100, 200, 300,000 people living in them when Europeans were still living in caves.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing when you go and you see these cities of 4,500, 5,000, 8,000 structures, you know. It's quite amazing.
Just,
and there's
you know,
a belief that there were cities very similar. Not as many, but some cities very similar here in America, but they were just flattened when the move westward went, and a lot of those cities were destroyed.
Yeah. Now, this is totally off course, but have you ever looked into the whole theories and stories about there being stuff in the Grand Canyon that's been covered up?
You know, I've read about that, but I've never come across anyone who had stories to tell about that.
Okay.
Of course, I haven't spent much time down in that, in that Grand Canyon area either. So I haven't come across, but I've certainly read about it.
All right, yeah, I just didn't know. Yeah, I was wondering if it ever came across your radar during your travels.
No.
Now, talk a little bit about this, because I live in Boston. You know, I'm in the suburbs of Boston, so I have visited some Native American reservations when I was very young. But I guess paint a picture, because we've got listeners all over the world. You know, we've got listeners in Europe, we've got listeners in Asia, so they may not be familiar with the setup here, because it sounded like, from a lot of the stories, the witnesses say the reservation is an ideal place for the UFO to land, or a good place, in one instance, for a UFO to crash, because it's so far off the beaten path and so vast that no one's really going to know. So I guess, like I said, paint a picture here. How big are these reservations, and is that pretty much the case that, you know, a UFO could land on some guy's property?
Oh,
within
absolutely.
Okay.
Because especially when you get out to places like North and South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, New Mexico, Arizona is more populated, but yes, but the Navajo Indian Reservation is huge, so that would be an ideal place to land where no one would see you, or if someone did see you, it would be a very small number of people, wouldn't attract a lot of attention. Out here in Montana, absolutely, there's only a million people in the third or fourth largest state in the nation, I guess third.
Oh, wow.
And Texas and Alaska, so you can imagine the wide open spaces here. Same thing in Wyoming, I think they have around 700,000 people. So there's just a lot of area for people to land that no one would even know. And that's, I don't know if you recall the stories over the missile sites. You know, South Dakota used to be proliferated with missile sites. Because it was barren, and I guess the government figured, well, if they're going to shoot at anybody, they might as well shoot out there in South Dakota where there aren't very many people,
Yeah.
Same thing with Montana, but they took all the missile sites out of Montana and South Dakota, but those missile sites were right along the side of the highway, and you had those people that, be traveling along, and there would be a UFO hovering over those missile sites. In fact, I've received several letters from people who have read the book who have told me very similar things had happened to their father or their grandfather or to them as they were driving along those roads in South Dakota.
Okay, so yeah, like I said, I just wanted to sort of paint the picture here for people that,
very desolate country.
Right, exactly.
See, when the government put Native people on reservations, they didn't give them prime land.
Hmm.
And so you've got a lot of non-farming land, a lot of sagebrush, a lot of desert-like conditions. So they didn't, they didn't give them the land that the homesteader wanted. They gave them the land that nobody else wanted out here in the West.
Right, exactly.
And in some cases, they happened to give them land where there was coal or where there was oil. That was unintentional.
Did they get to keep it?
Well, I think the BIA regulated it, and I don't know how much money they got from it. I think that's still a matter of it's still questionable.
But you said you've collected like 1,000 stories here. I guess I was talking about this with a friend of mine, and he asked me to sort of ask you this. So, give me sort of a ballpark breakdown of the different types of aliens. How many types have you heard about through these stories? Just off the top of my head from having read the book, I'm thinking of, some were described as sort of insect-like.
Mm-hmm.
Would that include the grays, or was that a distinction from the grays?
I think it was a distinction from the grays.
Okay.
Yeah. And those two friends, remember the two coaches?
Yes.
That was the one that encountered the grays, they were... although they felt that their bodies were insect-like because they were so skinny, but the eyes were definitely described the grays.
Right, that's what I was trying to sort of put my finger on. But there's also descriptions of human-like ETs.
Right. And ones that were very tall, but very thin. Ones that could appear and disappear at will. So I would say probably six or seven different types.
Interesting. Yeah.
But now in Mexico, I came across one that they said this Maya elder told me about a giant race that came from the stars. So that's
interesting.
Another one, right?
Yeah. So it makes you just wonder what's going on. Leaves me puzzled just trying to figure out all this.
Well, I think it does all of us, but I think one of the things it does for us is maybe it gives me comfort to know that we're not alone here.
Yeah.
You know, there are other worlds and other entities that are intelligent. And maybe if we can all get our act together, maybe we can come up and solve some problems together, live together.
Let's hope so, but I worry about the world.
But didn't you find it interesting, though, that they said that Earth, there were the violent types, and humans were one of the violent types in the universe?
Right, yes. You're referencing one of the star people, or E.T. said to one of the witnesses that there are five violent races in the universe, and humans are one of them. Which is
right.
That's a downer in a way.
But you know, I
it
mean,
makes
he's
perfect
right.
sense.
I mean,
though.
We just war and war. You know, we're constantly at war with somebody, or somebody on the planet is at war. You know.
Right. That may even be what draws them here. That might we might be such an anomaly that they're puzzled by what is wrong with us. You know. But I just
or
think
if
maybe,
we are their children. Why did we choose to develop the way we did?
Yeah.
You know?
I guess because our parents left us, so we're developed into...
Maybe so.
We have violent tendencies. Now, there was a pair of stories in the book that were also really strange. And that, again, this is what I love about the book. Not only that these are incredibly rare stories, but they're not just, oh, I saw a UFO. These are, like, mind-blowing stories. And in the book, there's two here. In the chapter, We Are Not of This Earth.
Yes.
Which I just thought.
My favorite women there.
Oh, amazing. Tell me about Ritha, because you met her. She says that she, you know, was not of this earth, that she has quite a story there. You can tell that. But what I thought was striking was that she said she had no belly button, and she showed you. So, I mean, you saw this.
That's true.
With your own eyes.
Yeah, I saw it with my own eyes. Well, she had been in the military. She had been in the U.S. military and had retired from the U.S. military. And she told this story to me. She had been in the military with my uncle, and that's how I met her, was through him. And she told me this story about this elderly Indian woman coming upon her on a crash out in the, like, the swamps. And that her mother was dying. And this Indian woman took her and said, this is my granddaughter, and raised her. And nobody ever said a word. She got her a birth certificate and everything, and but she really knew nothing about where she come from, who she was, but she always knew she was different. There were just different things about her, how she didn't require much sleep. She didn't have a belly button. She had this connection, with the universe that was unexplainable to her. And she was really, a fascinating person.
Yeah.
And I found the other lady, the one that was claimed to be part Indian and part black and part alien.
Yeah. That was actually, that reminds me. You're reminding me now. I'm thinking about that story. Yeah, that was a remarkable one, too.
Well, I found interesting. Remember her, she always said that her father was always cold, her father was always cold, and when I went back looking for her, because she came to my uncle's funeral, and then I couldn't find her. And so when I had gone back a year later, you know, to settle his affairs and everything, I kept looking for her, and I went to this one place, and this old man that was on the river there said, well, you know, he implied that, he said she didn't like men, but then he went on to say that she was the strangest woman he had ever met, because every time he saw her, it'd be 100 degrees weather, and she's wrapped up in some blanket like she was freezing to death. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because she had described her father in that way, that he was always cold. Do you remember that?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. That whole story was striking in a lot of ways.
That here is some observer who doesn't even know her story, but this was the comment that he made about her, that it would be 100 degrees out there, and she would be wrapped up in a blanket, you know, and he just found that, that he thought she was a strange woman.
Right.
But I never did. I never was able to locate her. Maybe if she reads this book, she'll contact me, but never saw her again. You know, I saw her at my uncle's funeral, but after that, I never was able to find her. And none of his friends knew who she was. When I said, you know, do you know it? When I described her, none of them knew, you know, knew of her.
Yeah, very strange. And the relationship between her and her father, who was ostensibly, or, you know, in this story, was an alien, was very interesting.
Her father was an alien.
She said he never spoke at all.
And thought when the crash at Roswell happened that they had come for him. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that an amazing, you know, that was just an amazing revelation to me, that, you know, he was sure that his people had come for him, that, you know, he had been stranded here and that they had returned for him. Well, then in the other story that took place where the group was rescued that crashed, and that was before Roswell ever took place.
Yes, that's the one where the ship crashed on the witness's grandfather's land, and they stayed there for like 6 months. They had enough stuff inside the ship to last for 6 months, and they were there for 6 months, which is amazing. To think that this happened and never got out, if it's true, obviously.
Well, you know, and if you'd ever go there, you'd understand why. I mean, it is so far removed from civilization that you know, I mean, it would be an astronomer's paradise, because there would be no light infraction at all. It's an unbelievable place. But literally, I mean, it's miles and miles and miles away, and I was there, you know, so. And it's totally isolated, totally isolated. I don't know how anybody could live there and ever, you know, I mean, there'd be no way of getting out to doctors or anything, you know, just totally isolated. And in that story, they were rescued.
Right.
But they had told him that was what was going to happen.
Exactly.
Come for him, for them. And there was only one other family that was even in that region, and they had left and gone to live with relatives someplace else, and so he knew that they were safe, because nobody ever came out that way.
So it's just fascinating that these things could have been happening, and we have no idea, and for such a long period of time, it's amazing.
Well, I think there's a lot of places, both in there's a lot of places in Alaska, there's a lot of places in the western United States, you know. When you live in Boston, you know, you've got people all over the place come out here, you know, and I can remember when I first moved to Montana, well, it seems like we got a lot more people now, but for me, if I see 10 people on the interstate on my way to Billings, I think there's a traffic jam, because there's just not a lot of, there just are not a lot of people that live here, you know, and they all live in certain areas, you know. They're mostly, and the big ranches still exist, and the reservations are fairly isolated, I think about 10% of our population is American Indian here in Montana, so.
Hmm.
So, you know, the webpage or whatever is just something that you guys do for fun. Do you have a real job?
Well, that is our job.
Oh.
We don't technically get money for the hours we put in, but it is our job.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
How come you don't don't have any money. I thought you had a paper route.
Well, I'm taking a sabbatical to focus on my pottery.
Oh. How's that working out?
Not good, Meg. Not good.